Jai Gillett, and this is the Power of Women podcast. We're a platform that showcases and celebrates the resilience, strength, and achievements of women from all walks of life. So what I'm going to do in each episode is pose questions to my guests that are going to reveal the narrative behind their story by peeling away the layers and asking them questions. So if you're feeling unseen, unheard, or simply looking for inspiration, then the Power of Women podcast is a really great place to join the conversation. Just before I start today, though, are you following the podcast? The more followers, the more content we can bring to you. So today, I am super excited about the guest that I've got in the studio with me. And I know in talking with her in the lead up to this that one podcast is not going to be enough. We're just not going to touch half of what I'd like to delve into. So my guest today is an accomplished speaker, executive coach, and leadership consultant, and her company Emanate works with senior leaders and professionals in Australia and internationally. Additionally, she is a fellow of Oxford Leadership. Her personal story is a unique one that encompasses the Australian and Austrian Alps, the corporate corridors from Melbourne to New York, and a commitment to mindfulness and meditation over a period of 30 years. Joining me today on the Power of Women podcast is the director and founder of leadership and consulting firm Emanate, Emma Lang. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you. Lovely to be here with you, Jai.
Fantastic. And welcome to our studio, which I'm kind of coming to love as my second home.
Fabulous.
So, yeah. Emma, before we start, I'd just like to open up with a couple of questions that I typically put to the guests on the Power of Women podcast. Where did you grow up? Because I know this is an interesting one with you.
Yes. So a really interesting background in so much as my father started one of the first cafes in Australia.
Yeah,
down
wow.
at Lawn on the Great Ocean Road. And then he opened a restaurant at Mount Buller.
Fantastic.
So I had the
share the names with us, because those from Australia and particularly those from Victoria will know these.
Yes.
So the Lawn one was?
The Lawn one was called The Arab.
That's right.
It started in 1956.
Oh, wow.
And very iconic bohemian cafe, one of the first coffee machines.
Yeah, right.
I think started around the same time as Pellegrini's.
Ah, so I remember it as a kid growing up in where I grew up and going down the surf coast.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a wonderful place to grow up.
Yeah.
And then in the winter up at Mount Buller.
Yes.
In what was really a small village.
It was. I was there in the early 60s. I remember it.
I know. We both share that background, don't we?
Yeah.
So mainly Europeans that had gone and started the ski industry in Australia.
Yeah.
And so had the opportunity to go to school on the mountain, ski to school in the winter.
Wow.
And surrounded by all of the traditions of Europe.
Oh, brilliant.
And my family had travelled a lot as well. So there was always this very cosmopolitan feeling.
Brilliant.
Despite my parents both being Australian through and through.
And the restaurant was the iconic A-bomb, which was that hexagonal building.
That's right. Yeah.
It's probably still got shades of that today, but that fantastic, you'd walk down in the freezing cold and go and have pancakes, which was the staple thing on the menu. I remember that as my childhood. It was rich memories.
Yeah, no, it was an amazing place to grow up.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's the thing that is so interesting is that we may not have had such an exotic upbringing, but the quality of those first 7 years of our lives and what surrounds us, whether it's a suburban life or a life like mine, is all about the people that surround you and how they impact who you are today.
And so many big characters on the mountain and so much international influence.
That's
truly amazing.
Yeah.
So from all of that, what was the most powerful learning from your childhood?
I think there were a couple of things, but one of them was having a father who was very entrepreneurial and ahead of many things that were happening, and a mother who was an academic. So two very different types of characters. And my father had had severe dyslexia but despite all of that, went on to found these extraordinary businesses. He was the first Victorian of the Year and Australian of the Year. But one of the critical things was their belief in me. And that's one of the things in the profile of many women who have gone on and done a lot with their lives. If they've had a father and a mother that really believed in them and encouraged them, and I know this is true for you as well, Di.
It is.
It has a huge impact on what you believe you can have in your life, what you can do, and how you actually carry yourself.
There's the power of you don't choose the family you're born into, but there's the power of it, isn't it?
That's... Absolutely. And they are our first models of leadership.
Yeah.
So leadership being above and beyond the role we have in our lives, but how do we take up that sense of our ability to shape and move the way we want our lives to go?
So I can blame all of my my overbearing traits on my father.
That's right, lovingly.
But
well, we learn as much from the challenging and various, you know, elements of our parents that, you know, challenged us or pushed us, as well as those strengths that really encouraged us.
As you've already touched on, your life story is a rich tapestry of experiences and pursuits. And without getting too personal, could you share how your story came together from the snowfields, your sporting pursuits, your commitment to studying, and then that leading into practicing meditation, because it's a whole rich tapestry that we'd love to hear more about.
Sure. So as I said, my father had very severe dyslexia and then went on and overcame a lot of the challenges, in fact, even founding a school at one point. For myself, I also inherited that dyslexia.
Is that right? Is it genetic?
I'm not sure how much is genetic and how much is, of course, then part of the environment, but it was a very strong genetic component, I'd say. Mm. So growing up in a school with generally about 8 children, but having this dyslexia, I really experienced sometimes the challenges with that. And one of the ways it played out was that even though I skied around the mountain, you know, without a single care and was encouraged to be very courageous and adventurous as a skier, when I would stand in the starting gate, when I went on and raced, suddenly the nerves would take over and I would become paralysed. And, of course, that would become self-fulfilling talk. Mm. You know, if I felt I was going to crash and bomb out, I would. So I had this burning desire to overcome that. So as I went on, I went to university, studied psychology, did a lot of work on myself, became very interested in the work of a man called Timothy Galway, who had written a book about the inner game of golf, the inner game of skiing, that talked
Hence
about...
Hence the brand, Galway Golf.
That's right. Getting rid of that voice that limits us and amplifying the voice of our, you know, our potential to overcome that. And that then led further and further into what else can I do to shape my inner game, if you like, as he would put it. And that's where meditation came in. So what I found was by studying meditation, and I went into it very deeply.
Whereabouts did you study? Was that?
Well, I started in Australia but ended up going to India and really studying it very, very deeply.
So it was deeply.
Very deeply, you know. Mm. And what I found when I went back then after a number of years of studying meditation in India was I came back to skiing and I had that ability to quieten that inner voice. I was so much more attuned to everything
in my environment.
How old
were you by this stage?
So I studied meditation. I started in my 20s.
Right.
So it's been a long time, 62 now. Mm. So as you can imagine, I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah, that's a long practice.
But the ability to quieten that inner voice of the critic, to be able to be very attuned, and the ability to get past all those perceptions of what our limitations are. And ironically, and we'll talk about this later when we talk about leadership, everything that we feel that defines us, both the good and the challenging, has a way of limiting us. So when you connect to that place, when I connect to that place, which is almost above and beyond that, It's almost like there's anything that, you want, you can achieve. So it completely changed the way I skied. I then went on and taught skiing in Australia and Austria.
Right.
And I found that all those senses of obstacles started to slowly diminish as I kept the practice of meditation up.
And that quietening didn't dampen in any way the competitive drive, if it was in a competitive sense on the starting gate, because sometimes mm-hmm. a bit of nervousness and a bit of anxiety mm-hmm. is a good thing to spur you on. So
absolutely.
How did you balance the quietening and that little bit of oomph to get you over the line
that
first?
That is such a great question. Well, one of the things I'd say about that is it's all about what we make things mean to us. So, for example, before meditation, the nerves, the tightness in my throat was interpreted as, oh, I'm going to bomb out. This is bad. I've got to shut it down. Once I started meditation, in fact, I was more attuned to that. When you need to rise to the occasion, you can feel it inside, but then the way that you interpret it is completely different.
Greater clarity.
So in other words, it's like all of my attention is now rising to meet this requirement. You know, it's like if you're going to go in and bullfight, then you need to really stand up and rise for that occasion. In the same way, if you're going to go and pursue a mountain, ironically, I went on to, for example, in Austria, engage in extreme skiing, so jumping off cliffs, skiing in avalanche areas, which of course is very dangerous.
I know.
Wouldn't
I've done a bit of that. I've done a little bit of that. I'm not sure that all of it was intentional, and sometimes it was trying to keep up with others to not show my own fears. So, but wow, that's amazing.
But the really interesting thing that started to shift for me as well, which I didn't realise earlier on, was that when I skied fast, I went completely into the zone. My mind would go still, you know, once I'd got through the start date or once I was actually going down a mountain. But that, in fact, I had found that that was my way to access stillness. So after learning meditation, I actually didn't need to just ski to get into that zone. There
That's
were ways that I could access it wherever I was. And, of course, that was very useful later down the track when I was working with some and have worked with some very powerful individuals in, you know, the top story of some corporate building, to not be, if you like, intimidated by who I might be working with or dealing with.
Yeah, very valuable.
Or some of the other challenges in life. So there's a way in which you don't need to depend on something external to move into that place of being in the zone, whether it's peak, needing to be at your peak performance and very alert, or whether it's about becoming very still and centered to just be present with the person in front of you.
It's extraordinary because I'm doing a little bit of a reflection, because when I skied not to the same competitive level as you did, but I skied from age 3. And I used to get my rhythm in skiing, I used to have a favorite song going in my head, and that song wasn't a quiet song. It was Simply Red or something at the time.
Yeah.
And having the noise in my head propelled me down the mountain and overcame fears of ice and obstacles. But yours is, and maybe that's where I went wrong, yours is completely the opposite of that, of finding the stillness and using that as the
momentum. I think it's interesting because, as you know, I went on to study neuroscience, and it's really fascinating to see the alignment of some of the principles of neuroscience with some of those ancient wisdom traditions that I studied in my time in India. But the reality is, and this is what I've found again and again, is that, in fact, most of us have some strategy that really works for us. It's not always meditation.
Well, that's right.
You know, there's a great story about an elderly woman who, back in the 60s, went and sat in front of a supposed master who was talking about his far-out meditation experiences, and she was avidly engaged and nodding her head. And at the end of the talk, she said, you know, everything you've talked about is so true. And he said, well, how do you know? And she leaned in and whispered in his ear, I knit. So, you know, in fact, that's
so
what
that
I find.
That was her quietness.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, what I find for my work is that it's often about finding what are the strategies that people use that have worked for them and that they can then repeat more continuously to get the outcomes that they want in their life.
Mm.
You know, because we've all tapped into this experience. We don't have to go off to India and meditate.
No, we can do that for 10 minutes in the morning on the bedroom floor if that's
right.
What works for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can't believe through the conversations that I'm having through Power of Women just how many people practice practice meditation or various forms of mindfulness now.
Mm.
It is far, far more prevalent than one might think.
That's right.
And I think that's great.
Yeah, a lot of people don't talk about it. I mean, in my time living, in an environment surrounded by people meditating, we would have many famous people or top leaders in industry that would come to practice, but they often just don't talk about it, that's something that they do in the background that supports them.
Yeah, because it's not something to shout out about. It's very personal.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
yeah. So your practice of meditation, tell me, how does that intersect with your professional work as an executive coach and leadership consultant?
Well, interestingly, when I started in, I was in a leadership role in New York, another story, but brought a leadership coach in to work with me when I needed to do a huge restructure in the organisation that I was in, and found it to be very powerful. You know, the use of meditation plus having someone as an executive coach to assist you. So when I came back to Australia, it was the beginning of the executive coaching field over here. But I chose not to talk about my meditation background very much because in Australia we're
ready for it or?
Well, we're not a religious, there's a lot of overtones of religion or, you know, that sort
right.
of woo-woo, if you like, science or lack of science.
Aren't we a cynical
that's
mob?
Associated in Australia particularly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as progressive, I found, when I came back as some other places. Although one of the first CEOs I worked with was a believer in meditation. He was a CEO of a bank who'd put his own word around it called high performance mind, but it was actually meditation. But I really had this sense that you don't need to use so-called spiritual language or meditation language. At the core of it, it's actually principles and practices that you can access and support anyone to access.
Now I can
see
the intersection.
But to really answer your question, the way that I've seen it help the leaders that I've worked with is that if you develop a practice that enables you to be very focused and aware, and that awareness is not just about this core strength, but also an awareness of all the things inside us, including the things that we're not so great at or our downsides. But meditation allows you to lift outside your personality to some extent, that you can see all of those things without actually taking yourself too seriously or too personally. And that extends your ability to operate in different ways. So that awareness also and that ability to accept all the things inside yourself without taking it all personally actually enables you to be a lot more authentic. Because you can drop the veil. You're not trying to put on a facade of being something, which involves a lot of energy. Also, this principle that you can be very focused on what's in front of you, but be able to then step back and have more an awareness of the broader things that are impacting on you or your organisation for that matter. There was a great story in Time magazine a long time ago about a leader who every morning went out on his balcony, had mountains in the background, and he'd stare at his finger very intently, and then he'd draw his attention out into the distance, and then he'd move between the two. And he ascribed that ability to do that as the single most important thing in his leadership success.
Is it the power of the mind, or because I know in meditation you can almost go into a visual trance and different colours and senses appear in front of you. Is that a similar...
Well, you know, the people thing? Interview him were kind of like, what do you mean by that? That's a very esoteric thing to say.
Yeah.
So he went on to explain that the ability to hold the immediate detail, but then to pan right out.
Yes.
As a leader, you need to be able to bring your awareness to what's right in front of you and get into the detail when you need to.
But then
to be
picture.
Strategic, you need to be able to pan out and view things within the entire context of what's going on.
I.e. helicopter view of what's going on in the business.
The absolute helicopter view.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I find with the leaders that I work with, just as you need to do that with your business, you need to be able to do that with your teams, but also yourself.
Mm.
How do you come to be able to be really focused when you need to, but then to pan out and look at where am I sitting in my life right now? Where am I sitting in my career? How does this fit in with the principles and the values and my sense of what's my purpose? Otherwise, sometimes you can find yourself actually living in line with something that was what you wanted a while back but no longer meets your needs, or what doesn't meet the needs of the organisation anymore. So that's an important thing on every level, from the individual right through to the bigger picture of the organisation.
So when you started this and bringing this into a professional context, were there many women on a similar journey such as yourself? Clearly not for Australia, because you chose to put that not at the forefront of your of your pitch, but in New York, I'm guessing you weren't as unique as you would have been when you came back to Oz, or...
Are you talking more in terms of working in senior leadership areas?
Yeah, and this...
the meditation
and,
as well?
This blended approach of bringing it in.
No, well, you know, as I said, this one bank had bought principles of meditation into supporting leaders and getting them to connect to their
authentic
self.
And interestingly, that was a male who...
It was.
...leader.
Although they had brought a consultant in, a female consultant, amongst a group of McKinsey consultants to do the work. But it was relatively... There was a small seed of people who were starting to do this work of bringing these principles into the corporate world, but there weren't that many. And, of course, to the point you're making as well, there weren't that many women. You know, I've now worked in this field for over 25 years. There weren't many women in senior leadership roles around the leadership table. But the ones that are, you know, what I've discovered through the work with many of them is what are the practices that they've had that have enabled them to be where they are. And to what you and I were both talking about, and I know I've spoken a bit about your background, having early in your life, particularly a strong father figure that you admire and get on well with, that encouraged you, that actually told you you didn't have limits, has a lot to do with what we believe we can be and do, and that's what I've seen in many of the women leaders that I've worked with here in Australia or anywhere in the world.
And it's why I asked that question in all of the podcasts as where did you grow up and what's the most powerful learning from your childhood, because I have, without the study and benefit of learnings of what you have, I recognised that very early on in identifying strong leadership traits when I was looking for executives for my clients, that understanding the personal bit, where they came from, you know, what happened around the dinner table, and some of those questions are quite personal, but you get there through conversation.
That's right.
Told me as much as what an experience in a workplace and a particular position that they held. It was as valuable in assessing potential.
Absolutely. And I know you've done so much work having to, you know, really evaluate at a,
that's right,
pretty quickly. I think what's really wonderful, though, for us all to know, and what I've discovered through the work one-on-one with people, is that most people have that little voice of knowing that they have this potential. And if you can just really believe in people and give them the opportunity to let that shine, I've seen people really open up and expand.
That's intense, just you talking about that.
And the reality is that there's very few people who haven't had some challenges in their life.
Of course.
Mm. In fact, a lot of the research around our most significant leaders is somewhere early in their life, they had to take the risk of being isolated. They didn't always ask for it, mind you, but something meant that early in life they had a challenge. It often meant that they had to step out from what was their clan. And from a neuroscience point of view, we know that from an evolutionary point of view, it's in our DNA and our neuroscience that being separated from our sense of the group was akin to your own survival being at risk.
Right.
So we don't want to do that. But if early in your life you've either had the friendship group kick you out, or isolated for some reason or another, or having to go against the tide to stand up as something you believe in, if you have done that and experienced that you can survive it, it enables you to go on and be a leader in your own life, to make choices that may not make everybody happy.
It's really interesting.
People, you know, make the tough choices to do what's right for an organisation or right for yourself, even if it goes against the tide.
My mind's ticking, so I can imagine somebody tuning into this podcast will be recalling episodes in their life that they've experienced, and this will be starting to really resonate with situations they've found themselves in, and and then how they've developed over time and how their characters have played out. Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you, Emma. Coming up, we're going to discuss this further with Emma. So, tapping into one's authentic self. Now, clearly meditation is a way of tapping in. If it's not meditation, what are other ways to tap into your authentic self?
Yeah, well, as I said, I rarely talk about meditation with the people I work with. What I find is that when you uncover when people have worked at their best, when they've overcome challenges, or what they do when in the past when they're under a great deal of pressure, you'll find what that is. And the neuroscience demonstrates a lot of this. So, for example, if I just take the time to stare out a window toward the distance, at trees or the sky, I'm triggering the same brainwave state as between wake and sleep, which is very relaxing and very focusing. If you, for example, were a swimmer, or if you played netball, or if you walk and go into a bit of a zone, I rarely meet anyone that hasn't got strategies that work for them. And all you need to do then is see how you build more of that in. You know, in a fast-paced world where we're constantly on, how do you actually enable yourself to take those things that refresh your brain and connect you? That's what I think it's all about. And back to the other point that I was saying earlier, most women don't necessarily have what you and I both had, which was someone who strongly believed in us in our lives. But we can usually find in anybody a time when they were backed by someone, or a time when they overcame phenomenal odds and succeeded. And all you need to do is keep enabling people and getting people to recognise it and then see how they expand that in their worlds. And it's incredible what the human spirit and what anybody can accomplish when they do that. You know, I'm currently working with someone who's, you know, a chief scientist. someone who's in politics, you know, a female who's in a very senior position in banking. And in each one of their cases, they're doing completely different things. But when you can recognise their strengths and they have someone that they feel is in their corner, it's amazing how it enables people to then take the next step and the next step. And importantly, learn to do that for ourselves.
It's not necessarily how you tap into it, but the really important thing is making sure you make time to tap into it.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And if you're used to always putting everybody above yourself, then you
being a martyr.
you have to get over that and recognise that you have to actually nurture yourself before you can really do, you know, as they say, put the oxygen mask on yourself before you can put it on anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, in 25 years, I rarely hear men talk about feeling guilty about doing stuff for themselves, but women will.
So from your experience, Emma, working with female executives and leaders, what do you find holds women back from tapping into, reaching into their full potential? I know that's a whole podcast, but...
Well, one or two things to say there.
Mm.
Firstly, most women attribute their success to hard work, not to their intellectual capability, to talents and strengths, to their zone of genius, which is a whole other thing we could talk about. If you have always put your success down to working hard, as opposed to these innate qualities that you hold, then you're more likely to burn out and you will not start working smarter rather than harder. Men, now I know I'm generalising, are more likely to be able to own what their strengths are and talk about how that got them to where they are than women.
Okay.
So that's one thing.
Yep.
As I've already touched on, a belief that talking about my attributes or my achievements is blowing my own trumpet.
Yes.
So what I'm constantly working with women around is, how do you see what you want to achieve that's going to impact on many others around you? It could be actually the achievement for your family. It might be something that's going to make the people you work with get greater outcomes. It might be changing the dial on something important on a social or commercial level. When you can put that above thinking about promoting yourself, it enables you to kind of leapfrog this virtue that's been encouraged in and socialised in us as women, which is being modest.
That makes sense.
And when you can talk, when you realise that by not talking about what's been accomplished, you're also diminishing everyone in your team and everyone around you being recognised as well. That then enables you to have the visibility and to be comfortable to stand up and speak out.
Not everybody has the benefit of some of your executive coaching and brilliant leadership advice. So, very high-level view, what are some of the things women can do to propel themselves forward to get over these limitations that might be holding them back?
One of them would be to recognise that the inner critic, the imposter syndrome, is something that's not just you, that everybody has. And in fact, the data suggests that it's equally between men and women. And so to recognise that it's human to have that. And in fact, it often makes us strive harder. But to then step forward anyway, to choose to step forward anyway, that's one thing. To get the support you need around you and to feel worthy of asking for it. I don't know how many times I've worked with women who are earning really good money, but they don't want to pay for a cleaner. They think they should be doing all of that as well at home. Or they don't like to ask for help from others as much as they could. To be comfortable challenging, to be comfortable having the courageous conversations.
It's interesting you just said that, because I could have put courage against every one of those things that that you just said.
And so going back into your own personal story is something that I would encourage every woman to do. because sometimes we're unconscious of what those strategies were. You know, we could call it your success strategy. The thing that enabled you to rise above challenges before. And that's your formula to keep doing that with other things that are in front of you. And to keep remembering that you are where you are, not because of hard work. So how do you recognize and acknowledge those incredible qualities in yourself? And recognize that when you think you're blowing your own trumpet, you're probably just moving somewhere along the dial slightly further from that modest person that you think you need to be.
Brilliant. Thank you, Emma. We could go on about this as we suggested for quite some time, but I know we're going to run out of time today. Could I just ask one of my last questions? I've got one of three that I typically ask guests who join me in the studio. What is a phrase that defines you?
A phrase that defines me. Life is growth. That the limits are what we then put in front of ourselves. So change the way I look at the world, and then I can change what I can have and do and be.
Which your life story suggests you have put a lot of time and energy into doing. Well done. So how does somebody find you and engage Emanate?
So my website is www.emanate, emanate.com.au. There's also a book that I wrote some time ago that brings together the neuroscience with what I've learned from ancient wisdom.
And that is?
And it's called Spirals, and you can purchase that through my website.
Terrific.
It's really a self-coaching guide. And, yeah, the website's a good place to reach out on the inquiries page and
excellent.
See how we might connect and do something.
Thank you. Thank you so much for a really enriching conversation today. And thank you to listening to the end of the podcast. So if this particular episode or other episodes resonate with you, please be sure to follow and like us. And you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram and Facebook. The Power of Women podcast can be a little bit tricky to find because, as you can imagine, Emma, the phrase Power of Women is highly sought after. So be sure to look up the podcast as the Power of Women podcast with Di Gillett. You can also reach out to me directly on the Power of Women website, which is powerofwomen.com.au. And on the contact page, check in and let me know if there's a guest or a topic that you would like me to pursue. Thanks so much. Until next time.